of lifelike things, replicate, respond to environmental stimuli, take on a patterned complexity. They've never achieved life itself, of course, but they demonstrate repeatedly that complexity is a natural, spontaneous, entirely commonplace event. There may or may not be a great deal of life in the universe at large, but there is no shortage of ordered self-assembly in everything from the transfixing symmetry of snowflakes to the comely rings of Saturn. So powerful is this natural impulse to assemble that many scientists now believe that life may be more inevitable than we think, that it is, in the words of the Belgian biochemist and Nobel laureate Christian de Duve, an obligatory manifestation of matter, bound to arise wherever conditions are appropriate. De Duve thought it likely that such conditions would be encountered perhaps a million times in every galaxy. Certainly there is nothing terribly exotic in the chemicals that animate us. If you wished to create another living object, whether a goldfish or a head of lettuce or a human being, you would need really only four principal elements: carbon, hydrogen, oxygen, and nitrogen, plus small amounts of a few others, principally sulfur, phosphorus, calcium, and iron. Put these together in three dozen or so combinations to form some sugars, acids, and other basic compounds, and you can build anything that lives. As Dawkins notes, there is nothing special about the substances from which living things are made. Living things are collections of molecules, like everything else. The bottom line is that life is amazing and gratifying, perhaps even miraculous, but hardly impossible, as we repeatedly attest with our own modest existences. To be sure, many of the details of life's beginnings remain pretty imponderable. Every scenario you have ever read concerning the conditions necessary for life involves water, from the warm little pond where Darwin supposed life began to the bubbling sea vents that are now the most popular candidates for life's beginnings. But all this overlooks the fact that to turn monomers into polymers, which is to say to begin to create proteins, involves what is known to biology as dehydration linkages. As one leading biology text puts it, with perhaps just a tiny hint of discomfort, researchers agree that such reactions would not have been energetically favorable in the primitive sea, or indeed in any aqueous medium, because of the mass action law. It's a little like putting sugar in a glass of water and having it become a cube. It shouldn't happen. But somehow in nature, it does. The actual chemistry of all this is a little arcane for our purposes here, but it is enough to know that if you make monomers wet, they don't turn into polymers, except when creating life on Earth. How and why it happens then and not otherwise is one of biology's great unanswered questions. One of the biggest surprises in the Earth sciences in recent decades was the discovery of just how early in Earth's history life arose. Well into the 1950s, it was thought that life was less than 600 million years old. By the 1970s, a few adventurous souls felt that maybe it went back 2.5 billion years. But the present date of 3.85 billion years is stunningly early. Earth's surface didn't become solid until about 3.9 billion years ago. We can only infer from this rapidity that it is not difficult for life of bacterial grade to evolve on planets with appropriate conditions, Stephen Jay Gould observed in the New York Times in 1996, or as he put it elsewhere, it is hard to avoid the conclusion that life, arising as soon as it could, was chemically destined to be. Life emerged so swiftly, in fact, that some authorities think it must have had help, perhaps a good deal of help. The idea that earthly life might have arrived from space has a surprisingly long and even occasionally distinguished history. The great Lord Kelvin himself raised the possibility as long ago as 1871 at a meeting of the British Association for the Advancement of Science, when he suggested that the germs of life might have been brought to the Earth by some meteorite. But it remained little more than a fringe notion until one Sunday in September 1969, when tens of thousands of Australians were startled by a series of sonic booms and the sight of a fireball streaking from east to west across the sky. The fireball made a strange crackling sound as it passed and left behind a smell that some likened to methylated spirits and others described as just awful. The fireball exploded above Murchison, a town of 600 people in the Goulburn Valley north of Melbourne. and came raining down in chunks, some weighing up to 12 pounds. Fortunately, no one was hurt. The meteorite was of a rare type known as a carbonaceous chondrite, and the townspeople helpfully collected and brought in some 200 pounds of it. The timing could hardly have been better. Less than 2 months earlier, the Apollo 11 astronauts had returned to Earth with a bag full of lunar rocks, so labs throughout the world were geared up, indeed clamoring, for rocks of extraterrestrial origin. The Murchison meteorite was found to be 4.5 billion years old, and it was studded with amino acids, 74 types in all, 8 of which are involved in the formation of early proteins. In late 2001, more than 30 years after it crashed, a team at the Ames Research Center in California announced that the Murchison rock also contained complex strings of sugars called polyols, which had not been found off the Earth before. A few other carbonaceous chondrites have strayed into Earth's path since. One that landed near Tagish Lake in Canada's Yukon in January 2000 was seen over large parts of North America, and they have likewise confirmed that the universe is actually rich in organic compounds. Halley's Comet, it is now thought, is about 25% organic molecules. Get enough of those crashing into a suitable place, Earth, for instance, and you have the basic elements you need for life. There are two problems with notions of panspermia, as extraterrestrial theories are known. The first is that it doesn't answer any questions about how life arose, but merely moves responsibility for it elsewhere. The other is that panspermia sometimes excites even the most respectable adherents to levels of speculation that can be safely called imprudent. Francis Crick, co-discoverer of the structure of DNA, and his colleague Leslie Orgel have suggested that Earth was deliberately seeded with life by intelligent aliens, an idea that Gribben calls at the very fringe of scientific respectability, or, put another way, a notion that would be considered wildly lunatic if not voiced by a Nobel laureate. Fred Hoyle and his colleague, Chandra Wickramasinghe, further eroded enthusiasm for panspermia by suggesting that outer space brought us not only life, but also many diseases such as flu and bubonic plague, ideas that were easily disproved by biochemists. Hoyle, and it seems necessary to insert a reminder here that he was one of the great scientific minds of the 20th century, also once suggested, as mentioned earlier, that our noses evolved with the nostrils underneath as a way of keeping cosmic pathogens from falling into them as they drifted down from space.